I want to begin by going back a little. In February 2019, I sent a newsletter, another form of correspondence within my practice, in which I shared an image that was prompting me to make new work. I'd written, "This image from the Ulf B. Hansen collection, which I found scrolling through the Kununurra Historical Society's Flickr account while making work for Temporary Certainty last year, has rarely left my mind. It has me stewing over the relationship between leisure and colonization. All the violence leads to this." Narelle, you wrote back to me almost immediately. And looking at this image now, it still makes my stomach turn. Apparently it was taken in 1961, the same year the town of Kununurra was established, built from agricultural dreams of development that rendered places like this, what had been a home to Mirawang people, suddenly a picnic destination for the colonists. These people sit here with their children, less than 40 years after the nearby Umbulgari Forest River Massacre of 1926, the last of many that had preceded it. They sit here in 1961, eating watermelon, while net chains were openly used on Aboriginal people in this region until 1958. But what this image depicts has only continued in the present. And it's really this I've tried to capture in the work, all the violence within this. But I'm curious, what was it in my newsletter from February 2019 that made you, an Australian living in Madrid, reply?
I think it struck a chord with me, as I've often dipped into 35mm slides that my parents took, thinking of their intimate imagery as an archive. I rendered some of them as Petty Point in owner-builder of a modern California house with the word California crossed out. Others were assembled in a PowerPoint and saved as a video where for Ilford Colour, I intercut the images with quotes from Walter Benjamin, tracking the formative thoughts and early development of his son's speech, Stefan. Stefan was later sent into exile to Australia. My parents' photographs are from the mid-1960s, where I grew up in an inner northwest Sydney owner-built bungalow. Many of the images reflect the clearing and domestication of the bush block set back on a dead-end street on Darug land and waters. In the image you refer to, the punctum could be the girl child sitting with her legs splayed. Compositionally, she's just off-centre, her whiteness drawing our eyes. But it returned me to a memory of my family burning a huge termite mound up above the house while it was under construction. The triangular block of land tapered to a rock outcrop. This new suburb was bordered by a Ku'ringai Chase National Park. So in a very real sense, Alana, we lived your photograph.
I hope in my work, people are able to see that we're all living parts of these photographs, but it's not something necessarily grasped with ease. In October 2019, I shared some of the first images from all the violence within this on social media. In the post, I wrote about the kind of arrogance and violence grounded in the assumption that we, non-Indigenous people, have a right to be here. And by here, I didn't mean this spring in particular, but more Australia as a whole. I also included these words from Evelyn Araluen's Sydney Review of Books essay. She says, "Do you know what laws I have had to learn while you play in everything they protect? Do you understand that when you write the kangaroo, the wallaby, the bilby, the bandicoot, the cockatoo, the black snake, the water lily, the brush, the bush, the sapling, the ghost gum, that you are puppeting your hands through ancestors, through relations?" Someone who lived locally commented, they'd been to this place many times and said they'd be horrified to be categorized as violent or ignorant. They expressed concerns about my images, likening them to a form of surveillance they said was a violent act in itself. I mean, never mind the whole town had recently been covered in numerous surveillance cameras. My walk to do the groceries or visit the post office with my son. now available for viewing on multiple screens in the heart of the local police station every hour of every day. I think this kind of response illustrates how uncomfortable we are, or perhaps how unable we are to see ourselves. I think about this a lot. Am I really able to see my culture? To poorly paraphrase the Hindi writer Uday Prakash, the fish does not know the sea, the camel does not know the desert, the bee does not know the honey. I think we're kind of in a contradictory state that swings between deep knowing and blindness, like the fish and the camel and the bee. But unlike the person who commented on my social media posts, I don't see violence as something distant from myself. I know I'm implicated in it, like a sticky goo encompassing my being. I try to pull away from it, but ultimately can't. That's the nature of settler colonization. We're implicated indefinitely. I'm also aware of how colonization and nation states craft violence. Within this gamut is the violence of representation, the historical continuum of non-Indigenous people representing Aboriginal people, and the power that plays into and forges. So here in these pictures, I'm simply shifting the lens a little towards the colonists. And in doing so, it's interesting how quickly that discomfort or sense of indignation emerges. Ilford Colour draws on your own family's archive, quite literally close to home. It's a kind of geography and architecture that's really familiar to me too, but we never owned a house like this. My mother often cleaned them and I'd walk the grounds, or we'd be renting and move in and out of them all too frequently. So when I see your video, I look at it with a certain sense of longing that I remember from childhood. To belong, to own, to be home, to not move. But at the same time, I also feel angry at that casual, familial nature of colonization, how it's wrapped up in that deceptively simple dream to have a home, albeit at the cost of someone else's. Your use of colour and its inversion conveys some of that violence to me, and the accumulation of time passing, of the landscape changing, of people aging, of colonization solidifying, and of Walter Benjamin's son, Stefan, and his part in this Australian story too.
Speaking to you from Madrid, I've been looking over the photographs in all the violence within this, and want to take us into inner city Sydney. A few months back, I received correspondence from an artist and friend named Jackie Redgate. That state that swings between deep knowing and blindness has been at the centre of our conversations for decades. Jack sent a WhatsApp. Dear Narelle, I was just talking to Diana and remembered a scarred shield container tree you pointed out to me once years ago on street near. I went looking for it to show Diana, and I think this is it. It would have grown. Diana said it is a stringy bark and extraordinary. Jackie later wrote and sent more photographs. She said, I wrote to the council, but they said it was a scar from a car hitting it. Maybe better less people know so it doesn't get vandalised too.
That wounded tree in the busy city street that Jackie photographed is like a flag reminding you of another way of looking. In the Southern Highlands, there are still scar trees, but they are not revealed. They stand beside the road with the oblongs of a shield almost invisible under another layer of burning. This is because of the justifiable fear by elders of vandalism from locals who are still hostile to any thought of Aboriginal ownership, even of a tree. One of those aunties with persistent kindness still volunteers to teach culture at the primary school where my grandson learns from her, despite this prejudice. It's moving to read these thoughts on the place non-Indigenous people find themselves in, because of the hidden history of colonial violence and takeover. That picture taken in 1961 could have been my family picnicking in Ku-ring-gai Chase 10 years earlier, happy and ignorant, often near Aboriginal carvings, which even then had a huge aura. Narelle, you would know these places too. But nobody knew that the Darug people were still living in crevices of the vast Ku-ring-gai bush until the 1950s. Aboriginal people were not mentioned at school. We learnt about the discovery of Australia with black maps of the continent that gradually had seams of yellow light going through them, following the trails of the explorers, in inverted commas, journeying through country already deeply known, not by the explorers. You are right, Alana, about the deep discomfort of being non-Indigenous in ancient places and the constant sense of being blind to unconscious bias. Nothing can be known except according to the mode of the knower, as the theologian Philip Sherard observed years ago. Documenting those raped landscapes is painful, and the context for your installation at Carriage Works of the Palm Springs is their takeover by unknowing tourists. A Yolngu elder and old friend, Dr. B. Marika, and I lived together for a time in North Sydney. She didn't want probing or curiosity about her culture, and actually told me to learn about my own fundamental roots. Go back to your own culture.
The image of that tree at South Darling speaks to a world, as does the council's response. I mean, last year the public was generally shocked by what happened at Juukan Gorge. But what took place there is not an aberration. This is the story of our nation as it has unfolded in this way on a daily basis for over two centuries, and for most part, within the apparent rule of law. It's easy to look back at the past, to acknowledge the wrongs of others, as though we no longer perpetrate similar things. But there is a continuum with the past rather than any sense of rupture or break. The council's response is evidence of this, and we all play a part. But Diana, I'm really curious. Where did B. Marika's advice lead you?
Alana, I still mourn the Juukan Gorge. It was an outrageous ignorance and arrogance, and there must be retribution for the unfathomable destruction of irreplaceable heritage. But as you say, how to monitor the vast interior spaces when the actions are considered lawful, in inverted commas, is the same problem as always. Dr. B turned me back towards the basis of European language, law, and materiality. The Greeks invented colonialism and the Romans developed it. Soon after I spoke to her, I got an invitation to be artist in residence and manager of an archaeological excavation of a Hellenistic Roman theatre in Paphos in Western Cyprus by one of my former lecturers in archaeology at the University of Sydney, who was invited by the Cypriot director of antiquities to excavate the theatre. Nothing is taken out of Cyprus, and the Australians are required to publish everything in order to retain a license to dig. We worked closely with the Cypriots. That was in 1996 when I first went, and I was last there in the monthly season of 2019. My son Rowan, who used to go with me, beginning when he was 14 years old, became a photographer, skills learnt on the site, and now explores contemporary detritus in Australia. My old friend, distinguished Tiwi artist Bede Tungutalam, is very keen to be an artist on the Paphos site. The ancient Mediterranean is much less ancient than the Juukan Gorge, but does reveal different ways of being, often more congruent with oral cultures that harbour invisible spirits than with modernity. It is complicated. How is it in the Kimberley? What do the people think about the Juukan Gorge?
And the gag order Rio Tinto was still attempting to implement over the PKKB custodians. At my geographical time lag distance, I always feel about to cut or disrupt our conversation, wanting, like Diana, to know how you're feeling there, and then wake with the inevitable delay and read alerts of damage again. This time to the sacred Kuyang stone arrangement site at Lake Bolak, at the same time as I received your Cups of Nun Chai book from Delhi this morning, Elena, gracias. Sickened, deeply saddened, and I can only think of reaching out to friends there on the ground in Victoria to see if they are supported and okay.
I can't really speak for what others are thinking, but I can tell you what I think about Juukan Gorge. And unfortunately, I wasn't shocked by it or by news of the recent damage in Victoria you mentioned. This really is a persistent state of affairs where I live, and in Australia more broadly. It's not just about mines and farmers doing the occasional damage. This is the story of every house, of every road, of every dam. This is our story, but somehow we tend to think of it as unusual or shocking. At the opening of her book, Living on Stolen Land, Ambolin Quemelina writes, "You are on Indigenous land, swimming in Indigenous waters, looking up at Indigenous skies. There is no part of this place that was not, is not, cared for, loved by an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander nation. There are no trees, rivers, hills, stars that were not, are not someone's kin." I think our legal system is so ill-equipped, or no, actually, I think it's more accurate to say our legal system is very well equipped to enable the destruction of Aboriginal country. In WA, if you want to damage or destroy an Aboriginal site, you simply fill in a rather brief PDF. Since the Aboriginal Heritage Act was implemented in WA in 1972, the overwhelming majority of these applications, somewhere around 3,300, have been approved, all except three. Legally permitting this destruction and damage, because basically it is deemed to be in the national interest. It would be far more accurate to term the Heritage Act the Destruction of Aboriginal Heritage Act, because it has literally enabled the legal destruction of far more than it has ever protected. The fact that the destruction that took place at Juukan Gorge was legal helped to make parts of the hypocrisy of this system more visible. But there are thousands of similar instances we never hear about every single day. And even when things are clearly illegal, the path towards prosecution is almost impenetrable. The WA government recently decided not to prosecute Kimberley Granite for damaging important sites that the late R. Peters and his sister Mabel Julie, both acclaimed artists, were culturally responsible for. I think the fact our legal and political system, and by extension our culture, tries to compartmentalise Aboriginal sites runs against everything Quemelina says so clearly above. It really suits us to say an Aboriginal site is right here but not here, to build boundaries around them, to really acknowledge that every inch of this country is Aboriginal land, owned and treasured and full of story and history and memory, is really just too confronting for our culture to reckon with, because it points to the illegitimacy of our own life here. Instead, we claim blindness and then try to draw lines and borders around certain places in order to make our presence outside of these specific places more palatable. As someone who's worked in archaeology, Diana, how do you negotiate the compartmentalizing of Aboriginal sites, which are no doubt important, but then implicitly render other places less important? Is it possible to navigate that inherent hierarchy in a way that respects what Kwemalina has said?
Alana, you write that to acknowledge Aboriginality in every part of the land is impossible for non-Indigenous culture to reckon with, because it points to the illegitimacy of our presence here. And you point out that we draw lines and borders around places and makes laws to justify that. Yes, that is exactly what we do. 30 years ago, I made drawings about the imposition of the grid on the Tharawal and Wadi Wadi middens and relics in the sand dunes of the south coast around Wollongong, because that is the way our culture since the 18th century functions. Order is created, we think, by proportion and making maps and boundaries imposed on land, not only in Australia, but wherever the colonial powers rested. We layer the grid of text on oral cultures, the building of surveyed hard roads over dirt tracks, the construction of heavy monumental built environments where none were. We saw the land as hostile and to be conquered, and destroyed fragile ecosystems in the process. We put up fences, making ceremonial sites inaccessible. We put people from open spaces in terrible prisons for crimes that are often incomprehensible to them still, Aboriginal people, I mean. No one can deny this. Compartmentalization is the way Europeans like me are, a basic requirement in our education system, in every institution. We sift, we categorize, we think in abstract concepts. In the Tiwi Islands, everyone can be an artist and would be required to do so for ceremonies, unlike our artists who have to be part of a hierarchy to survive. This is why I have been so moved by the people I have known in Northeast Arnhem Land and the Tiwi Islands, still with land and language, although the mining at Nhulunbuy has been devastating, hence the Bark Petition very early in the 1960s. And the people's generosity in wanting to educate Balanda or Murrintawi, the white people, and work with them in both ways, methods to get the best from both systems. This I do find extraordinarily generous. Otherwise, if we can't work with people, where are we? My colleague, Professor Leslie Head, now head of the Academy of Humanities in Australia, said on Radio National last year, how much improved archaeology had been after decades of interaction. There is slow growth in working together. She dug at Jinmiam in the Northern Territory with local custodians there in 1996 on the border of Western Australia and the Northern Territory. Tiny events, perhaps, but pointers. I've spent nearly 10 years with some interruptions trying to document all the forgotten old artists and the patterns instigated by young artists that I worked with in the Tiwi Islands in 1974. I wanted to recount how modernization happened, how art centers became important. It's from a personal perspective, interspersed with research. In order not to despair at the situation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, I've taken a personal position that to be close to one Aboriginal person and relations is at least to support them through thick and thin and unobtrusively, that is something very small. We began with your discovered image of a white family absolutely unaware of what the rocky cave they sat in was about, ignorant that close by there was a massacre site. I love your powerful passion for bringing the colonial devastation to mind. This is very necessary. My viewpoint is that I want to mitigate the hopelessness of assuming complete incommensurability, between Indigenous and non-Indigenous ways of being on land, which is, of course, what the early rural settlers and many settlers today believe. Tentatively, I'd like to connect as individuals within the mosaic of Australia as it is now to redress and heal.
And to seek justice.
I agree with you in the sense that relationships are vital. They're all we really have to hold in this difficult world that we now unavoidably share. And I hope it is not completely incommensurable, but I'm also full of doubt. We certainly aren't seeing ourselves, our own role in the ongoing process of colonization to the degree that we really need to. That's what I'm trying to do with a lot of my art at the moment. And even through this correspondence, to forge something like an ethnographic or anthropological examination of non-Indigenous Australia, of our own colonial culture and of ourselves, to shift things so that we can start to think about the colonial problem instead of despairing about Indigenous issues. But it's interesting how entwined this is with Indigenous Australia. Even in this conversation, all of us keep reverting to encounters with Indigenous people or places or things. I mean, Aboriginal people are able to understand themselves outside of the construction of Australia as a nation. They have an outside of colonization to reach to. I don't think we do, really.
Some years ago on the outskirts of Melbourne, a Yolngu man, he was recorded as he danced with family to celebrate his granddaughter's year 10 graduation. They danced on a platform with cut eucalyptus branches rimming the border. And what I remember is that it was filmed from below with us, the TV news audience, looking up. I subsequently read that in 2015, when it had been filmed and aired, that snippet of video was the most popular video screened on the ABC that year. People are listening, people are looking. Just searched and refound it, it's still there. A suburban, if not Federation style house, partially visible behind them, as a kind of footnote to considering archaeology and to your provocation for a critical ethnology or ethnography of non-Indigeneity. Just over 25 years ago, I was invited to participate as a consulting curator for the development of a museum on the site of another house in Sydney, the Museum of Sydney, on the site of the first government house, which was by necessity a highly contentious ground, itself a disputed and sensitive archaeological dig before redevelopment, and deemed to be representative of the first 60 years of colonial occupation. The foundational team was intercultural, interdisciplinary, and intergenerational. And soon after the inauguration of MOS, we received a critique from some Indigenous community members that they preferred that their material culture not be interwoven with the resurfaced archaeological rubble of the occupiers. We had significant Eora Nation material on loan from various museums. And I understand that the response from the museum staff that stayed on after the opening was swift, agile, and respectful. The Aboriginal culture material was collectively consolidated to a self-contained floor of the building adjacent to an important redemptive video work entitled Eora that had earlier been commissioned to Wawadjuri Kamilaroi, photographer and filmmaker Michael Riley. The reconsideration and relocation of Indigenous cultural material for this time was a deft museological move. Alana, far above, Diana mentioned, not in passing, that documenting those raped landscapes is painful. And thinking of the child navigating the stark, deliberately black and white shots in your series, In the National Interest, do you want to talk about their presence a bit, please?
You know, the child is my son. I didn't initially intend for him to be part of the images, but he is usually with me when I photograph and I occasionally take a few pictures of him for personal use. When the film was processed, his presence in these images spoke directly to the work itself. I think there's a playfulness, but also a horror in his presence here. And this bounces off the horrible sense of playfulness of the figures depicted in all the violence within this. These black and white images that he's a part of are small scale mines. Often looking for gravel, they dot the highways where I live, appearing persistently in the landscape, like cigarette burns piercing a tortured body. In the national interest is a picture of the world our lives are producing. And it's this world that my son will be forced to navigate.